by Susan Schultz from If I Don't Write It Down, It's Shh on Writing Dementia. Although dementia is a disease characterized by the mind's erasure, the process by which erasure occurs is physical. Sufferers, while they still have words, describe them in terms of objects and space. As David Clegg points out in an interview about the Travis Project, which he founded, Alzheimer's sufferers often think in architectural, spatial terms. Not only do they think a lot about home as a place, but their notion of language is also spatial, the past tense down, their thoughts behind the wall. He describes his process of editing transcripts of stories told to him by dementia patients as follows. Once I had a block of stories, I began to see patterns. For example, there's a strange tendency for people to create architectural metaphors to explain their memory loss. They might say a thought is under the floor or behind the wall, suggesting that it was physically present but inaccessible. People often describe events that happened years before as recent but removed in terms of distance. Mum lives 100 miles away now. Many of the stories are peppered with references to moving up or down, usually up, so the past is usually described as down. Many of the storytellers have told me that their room is above or even on top of, in the sense of superimposed, on the family home from their childhood. As a sculptor, I find the notion of symbolic space endlessly fascinating. Our speaker today is Dr. Sultan Darvish. He is a behavioral neurologist and trained organic chemist with an interest in medicinal chemistry. His research has been instrumental in determining the importance and expression of butyryl cholinesterase, I practiced, in the human brain. His research focus is the development of therapeutic and diagnostic agents for Alzheimer's disease with butyryl cholinesterase as the target. Thank you so much for coming to speak to us.
Thank you very much. I wanted to thank Reverend Borocker for this invitation. And it is a truly an honor and privilege to come back here. What do I mean by coming back? I came to Halifax in 1984 to go to medical school. And I belong to a small community here. I was born a Muslim, and I belong to the Ismaili Muslim branch of Islam. And we didn't have a place to pray. And this church allowed us to come here. So I remember as a medical student, as a resident, coming here at 6:30 on Friday. We stored our mats downstairs in the basement. We came to this very hall, and we prayed. And then we left the mats here, and then we came back at 4 o'clock in the morning and did our meditation. And then we put the mats away. They did the same thing on Saturday and did the same thing on Sunday. Until we found, we pray every day, and we found a place now, some years ago, in Burnside. But this is this was one of the first places where I prayed when I came to Halifax. So it is truly a privilege to come back. Reverend Hofker ran into me in Superstore. He asked me if I could come and talk, and then he told me what church, and I obviously was going to come. So there were a few things that I mentioned to him when we discussed this in my office. I'm not a scholar in theology, I'm a doctor, I'm a scientist, and I will try to bring that sort of perspective to this. I can't see. Yeah. So if we go to the next slide. I've never done it like this. I usually have my own. So what I thought we'd do is we talk about Alzheimer's disease and how Alzheimer's disease described the condition. We'll talk about some research that was going on. We'll go through some of the historical aspects of this. As I say, I didn't know the congregation, so I wasn't quite sure which direction to go, so I'm probably going to go all over the place. It's okay. And then we'll talk about the history of research in brain conditions, and I'll give you some of my perspectives about this. So the next slide shows Alzheimer, and he looked after, so he was in Frankfurt at the beginning of last century, and he looked after this lady in the next slide, Auguste. This lady was in her 50s, and she had cognitive and behavioral problems. And he looked after her while he was in Frankfurt. The next slide shows some of the chart people found, the original chart of this lady that Alzheimer kept. And the next slide will show some of her attempts to write. Alzheimer asked her to write her name, to write Frankfurt, and she was having difficulties. And we heard, you know, patients, people with Alzheimer's disease have problems with language, writing, and many other things. In the next slide, we see what Alzheimer saw. So when Alzheimer, when this lady was still alive, she was in Frankfurt, Alzheimer went to Munich, where he was offered a job, and it turned out that he was in the right place at the right time. Because in Munich, there was a school that was looking after ways to examine the brain, to stain the brains, to preserve the brains. And then when this brain was sent to him after this baby died, he was in the right place to look at the brain tissues themselves. And that's what he described. This is what he saw in the brain. This was all abnormal material that had never been seen before. In the next slide, these are all his slides from this lady. These are plaques and tangles that we believe that cause some of the symptoms that cause the brain to deteriorate. And this was very important, to look at the brain tissues themselves. Next slide, we see more modern ways in which we look at that. You know, Alzheimer, when he described Alzheimer's disease, he did not know what caused Alzheimer's disease. Today, 100 or so years later, we still don't know what causes Alzheimer's disease. But we don't know it at a much higher level because we have this. So the next slide shows the same tangles. These are different ways in which we look at the brain tissues. And of course, in Alzheimer's disease, one can never be 100% sure that it is that condition during life. One can be 80%, 90%, even 95% sure, but never 100% sure until you look under the brain, you know, under the microscope. That's too late. And this is why my lab has dedicated all the time to develop methods that we can be more accurate in our diagnosis of Alzheimer's disease during life. If you look at the next slide, the top panel will show all the brown stuff that is found in the normal brain. That's important. So Alzheimer described these things in 1906. This was described in 1980, right? More than 70 years later, by looking at the brain tissues. And they found that this was another abnormality that was found. So if you look at the top panel, there's a lot of brown stuff. If you look at the bottom panel, there is less of that brown stuff. This is one of the enzymes that's related to butyrogonadenes. Well done. I didn't know they were going to say that. Anyhow, so this is one of the enzymes that's related to that. And efforts were made to address this particular enzyme. And the drugs that we use today for treatment of symptoms of Alzheimer's disease were discovered because of this discovery, looking at the brain tissue. And that is very important. So if you look at the next slide, we talk about brain research. This is fundamental in everything that we do. The other conditions I know that affect people. My focus, obviously, is in brain conditions. So in the next slide, we see that we have dedicated, I have dedicated my time to do research in Alzheimer's disease, because I've always said that we have demographics are changing. Age is one of the most important risk factors for Alzheimer's disease. And as we all go older, there's more and more Alzheimer's disease. And therefore, we have to find causes and find cures for Alzheimer's disease, because failure is not an option. You know, the United Nations usually put these reports every year, and you can imagine the United Nations is concerned with diseases and conditions that affect most people in the world. And traditionally, it has been infectious diseases, malaria, cholera, and all that kind of stuff. About 3 years ago, they put out a document that said that if you don't do something about dementia, it's going to bankrupt everybody. It is a huge issue. And so we established this brain bank in 1994 right here in Halifax. And the next slide will show us what our vision is, what our mission is, and what we would like to do. So when we started this brain bank, normally there are brain banks around the world in Canada, there are two others in Canada. People collect these tissues to do research for themselves. And I decided that that is just not right. There is a clever person somewhere in the world who will find a cure, cause and cure. So we are one of the rare brain banks that sends brain tissues around the world for people to do research, because we have to do this as collectively. So in the next, so we have collected over 900 brain tissues, which is an enormously generous thing for maritimers to do. You can imagine that. In the next slide, they show some of the most common. This brain bank was started with the help of Alzheimer's Society of Nova Scotia and subsequently Dalhousie Medical Research Foundation. And so, because it is Alzheimer's disease, we started out with Alzheimer's disease as a focus. Most of the patients we have Alzheimer's disease. But now, through Dalhousie Medical Research Foundation and the Molly appeal that happened last year, we have now funds to expand this to include other conditions such as multiple sclerosis, such as ALS and other things. Next slide will show history of brain research. This is a cool thing. You know, if you look historically how research has progressed, it has progressed incrementally. It all has depended on the prevailing attitude about things. So if you look at the next slide, this was Babylonian time. That was the time, some 3,000-4,000 years ago, where people said, well, you know, if we want to figure out what's going on with people, we'll look at the entrails of animals. Right? We'll look at the liver of a chicken and see what it's doing, and then we can predict other people's lives. This is what people did. In the next slide, we move forward. There was this attitude about animism at that time. People said that there was the disease, the famine, is caused by the wrath of God. And if that is the case, what is the point of doing research? So if you look at the next slide, if you look in the Iliad, Homer wrote about this story where the priest, Apollo's priest's daughter, was kidnapped and treated badly by some of the folks. And in this story, the priest went to Apollo and asked for justice. And there was famine in the land. And people said, you know, there's no point trying to figure out why this famine is going on, because it is the wrath of Apollo. So let's return the daughter and give some offerings to Apollo, and everything will be fine. So that was during Homer's time. Next slide, we move forward. It is Hippocrates. You know, every doctor today, every single doctor will have to take Apollo's Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm, and many other things. And he set forward a path for looking at conditions, diseases, and examining these properly, systematically. And I can tell you, in my branch of Islam, science and religion are absolutely compatible. And that is the most important thing. And at the end, I'll give you my own personal perspective on exactly what I mean. And so if you look at the next slide, many years ago, in the Middle Ages, looking at the human body was supposed to be not allowed, right? But because it was felt that there was disrespect. But you know, people have looked at the body and they've figured out what causes disease and all that kind of stuff. So if you look at the history of looking at the body, people do that to understand disease, to do science, to try to find a cure. But there were times when people did this for religious reasons. So in the 1500s, there were twins born conjoined at the torso. And the priest had to baptize these twins, but they were conjoined. And the priest did not know which one to baptize. Was this one soul or was it two souls? And he obviously had to do something, so he made a decision that he was going to baptize both the souls. And a few days later, they died. And now the priest was worried. What will the Lord say? How will the Lord treat me if this is just one soul and I have baptized two? So he commissioned an autopsy to be done to see whether this was two souls or one soul. That's a true story. And so they did the autopsy and they found that there were two hearts, there were two, you know, they were just joined at the torso, and there was two brains, two hearts, two everything. And so the priest had a sigh of relief. The Lord will not be upset. So it's like, as I said, one of the important things, people do research, they look at other models, they look at cell cultures, and do many other things. But it is fundamentally important that we look at the human brain tissue itself. In the next slide, you know, Alexander Pope famously said in this essay that the proper study of mankind is man. And this is absolutely true, fundamentally true in what we do. Next slide. So I'll share with you some of the things. I was absolutely thrilled when I saw the creation of Adam in front of the program today, because I didn't know that you were going to publish this. But if you look at Michelangelo, next slide, this is what you have, creation of Adam. You know, people have looked at human for trying to find the cause and cure for conditions, diseases, many other things. But people have also done that for art. So where did Michelangelo get inspiration to paint this on the ceiling of Sistine Chapel? Turns out, he was hanging around with these people who are examining the body in the autopsy. So if you look at the next slide, and you can look at your brochure as well, the outline of where God is that of a brain. Okay? So you can see this is an outline exactly like a brain. And there's, you know, it's labeled with what parts is. And this picture there is, you know, half of it. But the other part is a front part of the brain, top part of the brain, bottom part of the brain. It is really fascinating that, you know, some of these older people, in fact, Rembrandt painted one of his famous paintings of an autopsy, sitting down looking at people doing science. Next slide. This is, we'll go through a few of these paintings from Michelangelo. If you look at this one, Separation of Land and Water. The next one is Creation of Sun and Moon. And the next one is interesting one. That is Separation of Light and Darkness. See, in here, Michelangelo has God going like this, and you see the underpart of his neck. If you look at this carefully, you see the underpart of his neck. Next slide. Next slide. See, if you look at the underpart of his neck, and you look at the underside of the brain, that's where he has the entire outline in God's neck, what is under the human brain. And this is very, very interesting. How people have taken inspiration in doing research, not only for research purposes, for medical purposes, but for art. Next slide. Perspective. You know, Reverend Rothker came to my office and we talked about things and what's Islam's stand on science and all that kind of stuff. And I said, you know, I am not a scholar in theology. I can't go there. But I can tell you what I know. And if you look historically, next slide, there were many Muslim scholars such as Avicenna, Ibn Sina, who wrote the canon of medicine. He wrote many books. And in fact, he wrote the canon of medicine that was a 16-volume treatise on medicine that about 10 years ago or so, the American Medical Association translated that into English. And this was was the Bible for medicine for a long, long time. And these are the individuals who actually translated the works of Aristotle and Plato and Socrates before he went to Europe during the Middle Ages. That is 1,000 years AD, approximately. Next slide. What about now? As I mentioned, I belong to Ismaili Muslim branch. And Isaiah as the Al-Qa'an is the imam, the leader, the hereditary imam of this community. And here he is in his garb as the imam of my community, of about 20 million people around the world. No nation, he does not have a nation, but we are scattered around the world, in the subcontinent, in Africa, Canada, United States, many other places. So here he is in his garb as the imam. The next one. Here he is in his garb as the chancellor of Al-Qa'an University. He has built schools and universities around the world. And so I can only tell you by what he has done as a leader of a Muslim community, what he has done, and his attitude is, and our attitude, that's what our teaching is, that this is, religion is an intellectual part of one's being as well as faith. So I'm going to finish off by telling you my story of how these schools have been important. I was born and raised in Tanzania, East Africa. And in the early 70s, there were problems with schooling in Tanzania because there were many political issues that were going on. So I had to leave Tanzania and go to Kenya. And the school that accepted me was the Al-Qa'an Academy that was built by him. When I finished my university, well, my school, I came to Canada, to Fredericton. I didn't know where Fredericton was. Actually, when I was accepted, I went to the map and said, where is it? But I didn't have any money, right? Because of the political reasons, everything that my parents owned and built, the business in their houses were nationalized. And so why? There was no money. And I got a scholarship from Al-Qa'an Foundation to come to Canada. Because that was the fundamental thing that this community that he has said must happen. And so I got a scholarship. And it was funny because I got a scholarship from Al-Qa'an Foundation, but I didn't have any university. I'd applied to about 35 universities around the world, Australia, United States, Canada. And they told me, you got 2 weeks. You got to have a university to go to, otherwise you have to give the scholarship to somebody else. So UMB sent me a letter of acceptance. I don't know what would have happened with the other 35 universities. I just said, I'm going to take it. And so I came here, and it was through that scholarship from that foundation. So this is what has happened. When I finished my PhD, I started to earn some money. I wrote to Al-Qa'an Foundation in Nairobi, and I said, you give me this money, and through his teachings, you know, I've been able to finish my school. Do research, have a PhD now. I'd like to give some money back so you can have somebody else come. And they said, no. That was a scholarship. That's for you. This is what we have been told, that you just produce people and give them scholarship and encourage people to do science, educate themselves. Because, in the end, there is no faith in science and education. It's absolutely that, I'd like to thank you for your attention. Thank you very much.